This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T.
Stanley brings something to the table and has, you know, great thoughts, or or says, why is this doesn't make sense to me. If it doesn't make sense to him, there's every chance it's not going to make sense to half the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sit down and say, let's figure this out. I mean, you don't have to. You can, you know, create chaos or get upset or, you know, laugh about it and not answer the question. All those things sort of don't lead you further down the process, you know, because the question will come up again. Or that person, even if they don't say something, will ultimately feel like you're slighting them. You're not collaborating with them in the way that you, I believe, that you should. So you kind of have to embrace that and say, may the best idea win. You know, I come in, my job seems to be to come in with an idea, come in with a way in which to approach a scene, you know, or approach the character. And if his idea is better, we should probably go with that. And that has seemed to serve me relatively well with a very, so far, diverse and talented group of people.
Hello and welcome to episode number 179 of FilmWax Radio. I appreciate all the listeners. The last episode was a big success. A lot of people tuned in, downloaded, streamed, what have you, episode 178. No surprise in a sense that with the cast of White Reindeer and High Maintenance, two projects that I think have a tremendous amount of support, certainly evidently that's the case. But it seems as though a lot of people were really into that episode. And so thank you really for tuning into that and also for coming back this week and hopefully hereafter. If you are new and this is your first or second, third time listening to FilmWax Radio, a special thanks to you. Please do spread the word. I'm asking, as I do on every episode, that folks subscribe to FilmWax Radio on iTunes and that they also rate the show. There's a way to click on, I think, up to 5 stars. And I think you have only the option of clicking on 5. I kid, of course, that's not true, but whatever praise you can contribute, it's greatly appreciated. And also, you can leave, I believe, comments. We also have a Facebook page. Let me get this all out of the way, which is, you know, of course, facebook.com/FilmWax Radio. Please do like that page. Leave your comments or suggestions. I'm always happy to hear them. You can also just email me directly at adam@filmwax.com. But I'm trying to get a more engaged audience. So, again, if you have been listening to the show, it's a free show. But the support of your subscribing or your, you know, liking the page and all this stuff, adding my Twitter feed, all these things are going to be helping for me to get sponsors and, you know, grow the show. Grow in the sense of just continue to get on great guests and set up a more proper studio and things of that nature, get more help in here. But as far as the guests go, which today's show is a great example of, there will continue to be a nice blend of established folks from the film community as well as emerging ones. And I use that language very carefully because, you know, I don't have any preference or try not to distinguish too much. It's just that, you know, obviously there are extraordinarily talented people who are making films that are distributed, that are automatically well-funded, perhaps almost assured to have theatrical as well as a digital distribution, all these different things. And while there are others, there's absolutely no guarantee. Having said that, there's actually quite a few filmmakers that fall in the cracks. They are established. They may have an amazing track record and yet still have to fight for every dollar. Can't take for granted whether or not their next film will be financed and even distributed, for that matter. We recently had John Sayles. Now, he's pretty far along, and he can make something exciting happen regardless, but he still struggles, and each film he has to prove himself, and he's been making films for like 40 years. Then there's also one of my guests today, Neil LaBute, who, you know, also cannot take anything for granted, though he probably is at a level where he doesn't have to worry about finding work, but then again, what does that say? you've been doing something for 25 years, you figure you should have the opportunity to be a professional and continue to see growth in what you're doing, you know. But I guess that's not necessarily the world we live in anymore. And film, especially independent film, is certainly not the world that we live in anymore. So moving along, I do want to say that there are as many exciting projects coming out as there has ever been. And the filmmakers that I've been having on lately, as well as today's show, are great evidence of that. The first guest, again, is Neil LaBute. I met Neil last spring at the Tribeca Film Festival. I had been pre-screening films for Tribeca and then was invited to moderate a handful of screenings. And when I saw that the Neil LaBute film, Some Velvet Morning, was among those available to me to moderate, I, of course, you know, enthusiastically agreed to do it. And I did two of them with Neil. And I think we had a pretty good time. I mean, their audiences were sold out. They seemed really engaged and excited to be there. And I think we sort of just had a nice little chemistry. So over the course of the last 6 months or however long it's been, I've been keeping in touch. And with the thanks of Betty Kaplan, who has been a great assistance to me and this podcast going back to February or March of this year. Fortunately, she had a bit of a relationship with Neil as well and was able to help facilitate making this all happen. So thank you, Betty. And Betty is actually on the show a little bit. You might hear her in the background, and she chimes in toward the end of the segment. So I'm very, very happy to have had her help making this happen. So thanks again, Betty. And thanks, Neil. He was terrific. What a really great guest. You never know how these things are going to turn out. You go into each one hoping that the people will be talkative and giving and engaging. And generally that is the case. It's been my experience, but it's not always. And this one required probably as little work in terms of putting the show together as any I've ever done, I must say. He has a new movie called Some Velvet Morning. It stars Stanley Tucci and Alice Eve. It's just the two of them. I don't think there is I don't even think there's another human being in the film. So it's almost like seeing a filmed play on some level, but it's very cinematic and it's beautiful. And it all takes place practically in real time. And so that's why I said that. But Some Velvet Morning was at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it is going to be having a theatrical release here in New York starting this Friday, the 13th. However, for those who are not in New York and in a select few other towns where it's opening up, the good news is that right at this moment as you're listening to this podcast, right now you can watch Some Velvet Morning on cable and on various digital platforms. Neil, as he mentions during the show, will be in New York at the Village East Cinema on Friday and I believe Saturday evenings for Q&A. So if you want to meet Neil, and you can go then. I will not be there, but and those living in Scottsdale, Arizona, at the Harkin Shea 14. Sounds like a Cineplex. It will be playing there as of Friday also. And then next week on December 20th, it will be at the SIE Film Center in Denver, Colorado, at the Facet Cinematique in Chicago, at the Picture House in Pelham, up in Pelham, New York, just north of Westchester. It'll be at the Aperture Cinema in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and finally at the Burns Court Cinemas just on Friday the 20th and Saturday the 21st only in Lakewood Ranch, Florida. So coming up right now, my conversation with Neil LaBute.
You should call her.
Who?
Your wife.
What good is that gonna do? Make me say the words, I left you. I mean, I think she got it. I just left my other life for you. For you.
But you were not expecting me. You've made that very clear.
It's been a while.
Yeah, he is.
Why didn't you do it?
Do what?
Put that note in my pocket.
If you didn't think I was in love with you, then you just weren't listening. I would have done anything for you.
I had you there for a second, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Completely.
I thought that I'd come back here and I'd knock on your door and I'd be back in your loving embrace.
And Fred, it's very flattering.
Oh, come on.
Well, thanks for squeezing this in. I appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Yeah. But can you talk about what you're working on that brings you to
This is a project for DirecTV. I did a writing project for them earlier in the year, a thing called Full Circle. And I wasn't involved in the production of that, just in the creation, the writing of it. This was something we talked about doing another project, and what we came up with was a series of 10 short films. And what I offered them was the idea of doing something called 10 by 10, which is 10 different stories by 10 different actors, kind of long performance pieces, so the shot all in one take and in black
really?
And white.
Uh-huh.
And so we're shooting 5 of them here in New York and 5 in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And so we're just at the very end of the last, or the first 5. That's the project that I'm currently working
on. That's awesome. It's one actor primarily, mm-hmm. I guess, primarily?
Right, yeah, straight to the camera.
Like who might be today, for instance? Does anybody know?
Today better be. Judith Light, or we're not going to have anything to do.
I think I saw her in the lobby.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
That's who it's supposed to be.
Okay. Judith.
Uh-huh. And it's been a variety of people. Jenna Fisher was here the other day, and mm-hmm. Fred Weller, and
nice.
Louisa Krause, mm-hmm. Richard Kind we did yesterday out in Queens.
Yeah.
At a machine shop. So uh-huh. it's just a mix of,
that's
of
great.
Men and women.
That's fun. It's fun.
It's been fun, yeah. It's a nice black and white is something you just don't get to use very often. I've only used it the last couple of years. I've done a couple of short films that have black and white, and this project's in black and white. So it's nice to see something like that.
You must have a different kind of conversation, right, about black and when you're shooting in black and white, I guess.
Yeah, it's a shorter conversation usually.
Yeah, it's far fewer colors.
Fewer colors and
but there's a palette.
Fewer,
anyway.
Oh God, yeah, it's amazing. You know, it can turn out just a very drab gray, or it can be a beautiful kind of real stark black and white contrast, and that's kind of what we're going for here.
Not drab.
Yeah,
thank you.
You really have to be careful about, you know, because it's a solid, you know, singular unmoving frame. That one picture is very important. So you spend a lot of time saying, what is the backdrop? What's going to happen? Am I going to put smoke in this? Am I going to, that little fan we could have moving. There's a blank television behind us. Let's put something on that.
Yeah.
You have all those conversations that you would have for a film, but, you know, the range is limited because there's essentially one picture. But we're being very careful with those because you're going to look at that picture for 10 minutes. And you don't want it to not work in relation to the person who's sitting there trying to tell you a story. So it's the same. It's also a guy I've worked with a number of times. He shot Some Velvet Morning and 2 or 3 other projects. So your conversations are quicker because you know each other. They're still the same conversations.
Yeah. And is it kind of like an anthology series to it that kind of is there a through line that
well
that
it's,
is
it's
there,
a, there's or? A through line certainly in the way we're doing it certainly in the nature of it being these 10 confessional stories. There's no direct correlation from person to person. Full mm-hmm. Circle had an obvious sort of daisy chain effect from one character to the next. They were connected in
yes.
some way. Here there's no conscious work on my part to say here's the other side of that conversation, you know, or I hear them reference that person who must be the person I heard 2 weeks ago. So there's none of that. It's really just 10 very different stories, sort of 5 age groups from 20s to 60s, a man and woman in each of those age groups.
Right.
But other than that, there's no real sense of you know, this person will carry us from A to B, and then the next one.
Right, right. Yeah. It just sounds it just sounds very liberating way of approaching, you know, work. I mean, I don't know if you feel is this your? I think this is your first real TV series or project for
I mean, where I've been able to see it all the way through, yes. Okay. Yeah, Full Circle was one of the first things I wrote that was on television. I actually directed some television this past summer. I worked on the AMC series Hell on Wheels.
I directed a couple that's episodes true. Of that. Yeah, I think I saw that.
And I don't know that I ever would have done it, except that it was a Western, and I really loved the idea of working on something like that, and it's so rare, the opportunities of being able to do that.
Right, yeah.
And there's one on the air, you know, anywhere in the world that I know of. So, that was really the draw, but it was a great group of people, and AMC were very cool people.
Yeah, well, they've been having a good go lately, haven't they?
They have.
Yeah. So, Some Velvet Morning, I know we had a couple of screenings in Tribeca last spring, and it's now finally getting to New York here theatrically and on demand. And how's that feeling for you? Are you looking forward to that?
I am. It's, it's become, even just in my short lifetime of, my lifetime is actually not getting very short. It feels like it's long now, but... The work lifetime, you know, the time that I've been doing films or theater, the way in which material gets into the hands of people is changed, very, you know, evolved, some would say, or devolved in a matter of years. And ultimately, whatever it takes to get your material into people's homes or onto their watches now. You know, it's that people are watching it on their phones, which is a weird concept. I mean, for this project, this is probably the best film that I've done in terms of being able to watch it on your Samsung, you know, but it's certainly no easier and no doubt harder to attract people if you crack open the theater listings anywhere or a Time Out or I don't advise looking in Time Out, but I'm not bitter. I think that, you know, it's obvious that, you know, a person living in New York who even has the opportunity to go see so much, you know, art in various mediums hardly knows where to turn. You know, it's almost more frustrating to be here, to go, even if I had all the time in the world, I can't physically get to everything.
Right.
You know, it's almost better to plan your little trip for 5 days and go, I'm going to see this and this and this, and then I'll go home happy, as opposed to, can't get into Betrayal. Never make it over there to see that. Oh, I missed that. That was on Thursday.
Yeah.
You know, that's almost more frustrating. But to then throw yourselves, you know, with a small movie out into that marketplace and say, I hope everyone goes and sees it, is a little unrealistic. But the fact that it's at least out there and all you can really hope for is that you find the audience it deserves. That a few people find it in the theaters because it's still a great place to go.
Of course,
see something up on a screen.
Yeah, well, of course, and it's interesting. It's true. I think, you know, maybe if you started within the Company of Men and late
Friends and Neighbors came after that in like late 90s.
Okay, so it was so it's really been through the trajectory of this whole wild period of time you've been there. Like,
For me, I'm fascinated by VOD and all of that. I think it's a great thing on paper. I know nothing about the mechanics of it. Mm-hmm. You know, if anyone's actually making money and all, someone is obviously, or they would stop immediately.
Yeah.
It's just the way those things go. They go, oh, look, no money in this.
Right.
Let's frack instead. You know?
And the decision to, for instance, release Some Velvet Morning, for instance, 3 days before the theatrical, as opposed to the same day or 2 weeks after the theatrical premiere date, those decisions, you assume they're experts, virtually nothing to do with. Understood, right.
Yeah.
And is it even something you want to,
I suppose, get into that level of detail? You fancy yourself at least smart enough to be in on the conversation, you know, and it's weird when you've been in command of the thing, whatever size ship it's been, you know, whether it's this size or it's, you know, $200 million, they put you in charge of these things. Right up until they decide to make the poster, and then they go, "Oh, you couldn't have any idea what that should be like.
Yeah.
We're not even going to show you the poster. We're geniuses at posters. Well, when we're going to release it, or that sort of thing." And what you learn over the course of however many years is no one's a genius. No one really knows anything, and there's a lot of luck and a lot of, you know, hard selling, and you get lucky sometimes, and things go great, and other times, you know, things disappear, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it was good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply that was that weekend, and now they put so much emphasis on one weekend. And I think that's one thing that this half-life of then going out and being a part of the video world or these other revenue streams. It's always something they call that connected to money. You know, it's a revenue stream. Whatever they call it has some allusion
dollar and cent.
We'll make some money off of this. But in that idea, the idea that, you know, if I think about the way I grew up and so many movies that I couldn't see, I either had to travel, across the state to go see them in a bigger city, or they just wouldn't exist. You know, I'll find them someday on Turner Classics or, once DVDs started getting made, you hope that they got put out on DVD. But none of that existed. And to think, okay, I would open the New York Times at the library or when I was in college and go, oh, look at all the stuff playing there. That's great. If I could hear that, you know what? You want to see it a couple of weeks ahead of those folks in New York? It'll be on your television.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much right up next to flight, I would have considered that. You know, it's one of those great air conditioning, space travel. Space travel would be like fourth or fifth for me. I could care less about space. Going and seeing a movie at home, that's sort of in the zeitgeist at that moment or some, the kind of thing I wanted to see, but just I'm geographically thousands of miles away. That sounds like a great thing, and I'll pay $15 to do that. So I think it's a great idea, and you're not losing any audience. You know, you might be losing a few people in the cities that film plays in who go, yeah, I'll stay home and watch it instead.
Yeah.
But I don't think in reality, I think the audience is only expanding with the additional ways in which they can find their way to a movie.
But it's interesting because the same conversation it's great to have the option of VOD because, those guys that are living elsewhere, not in New York City or L.A. or a handful of other cities, they have this VOD or digital, now iTunes and all the other digital platforms, they have that option. But it's the same, it's the other side of the same issue because it's the very thing that discourages and disincentivizes people from opening an art theater. There's just no money into it. So it would be nicer if there was like an art cinema in every town or close enough where you could go and see these things. But there's no reason to open it.
I think that still remains impractical.
Yeah.
It's a quaint idea that we love to go gather in the dark and watch these things bigger than life. That's how, it's kind of, they've kind of become lore that way, that we go and we're enveloped in them. And I agree. It's a wonderful thing. And I think there are still movies. I saw a movie recently called The Great Beauty. It's an Italian film.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
And that was a film that I felt like, that felt great being in the theater and kind of like saturated with those images.
Yeah.
But I don't feel a huge amount will be lost by watching Velvet on some other format.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of films like that.
Not to say, by the way, that you created it with that in mind.
No, not at all. Love the idea, and it was fantastic at a festival, and that's going to be great during whatever period the film is out there to have that option to see it that way.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think the experience is ruined by seeing it. You know, it becomes proportionate. You know, the closer it gets to my BlackBerry screen, the less I think I would enjoy it. But there is a happy medium there somewhere. Your television screen, even a laptop, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of an art house in every city, even then, rotating, if they have one screen and they're rotating a movie a week, that's only 50 films. There are so many films out there that would not get on that screen.
Right.
And I would much rather have seen them or had the opportunity to see them than to go, well, they weren't in the 50 that came to my city.
Yeah.
So it still remains, I think, a really viable way to see, in particular, a kind of film, a lot of films from other countries and or out of the independent movement that aren't relying on the kind of bombast of the spectacle that an Avengers or a tentpole movie today says, we're going to throw that 3D huge experience at people. That's part of the the glory of this thing, glory in quotes as far as I'm concerned, but that's part of what we're selling is that experience, as opposed to here's a small chamber piece about four people. I think that experience can be enjoyed on a smaller format.
You grew up for some reason I'm thinking New Jersey, but you didn't grow up in New Jersey, did you?
No, not at all. I was born in Detroit, and then I moved at a young age to Washington State.
You mean as still as a teenager or something like that? Or?
No, like a 3-year-old.
Oh, okay. Did your parents?
I mean,
like,
I was
were
a very adult
3-year
old.
Yeah,
yeah,
I'm
I
sure.
I probably didn't come off like a teen very often.
Oh, so your family relocated to the
Pacific
Northwest.
My mother was from there. She was from Idaho, so we were very close to there. We were more, you know, basically resituated ourselves near her family as opposed to my father's family, which was Michigan. So we made that. They, in fact, my parents had met in Idaho, gone back to Michigan for a few years, and then we all moved to Idaho when I was you know, not even in school yet.
Okay. But were your parents, was your mom or one of your parents, were they like into films? Were they, I mean, who was it that kind of...
Movie watchers in their own way.
In their own way? I mean, you grew up in the 70s?
Yeah. So we would, you know, we would pile into the car and go to a drive-in sometimes. I would see a certain kind of film with my father and a certain kind of film with my mother. Like my mother would go, there was a revival house. I guess it was pretty much, it wasn't always a revival house.
Mm-hmm.
But it would play certainly bigger revivals and hold pictures for like the opposite of what you're describing, like for a year, you know. And
then, sure, yeah, yeah.
And then back in that period, there was, you know, movies would sit in the theater even in New York for a long time. So Billy Jack would break their local
it's
record
huge.
Of like being in there for a year.
Oh, that was a huge movie, yeah.
Romeo and Juliet or
Zeffirelli, I mean.
Yeah, Fiddler on the Roof, that kind of thing would play there. But they would revivals would come through, and she took me to Gone with the Wind there, and that's right. Whereas my father would be like, "Let's go see Papillon."
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it has Steve McQueen, that was let's go see that.
And
Dustin
Hoffman,
Dustin Hoffman was
a little
suspect
ethnic.
To him.
Yeah,
yeah,
well,
I was like, that's, he's not so interesting. I hope he dies early. You know, much to his chagrin.
In the film, let's just stipulate what you meant by
that. Yeah, not early in his life.
Yeah.
But
interestingly enough, he's outlived Steve McQueen by decades. And,
he certainly did, yeah. So that was the kind of experience I had, watching a lot of, I watched a lot of films with my father on television, Westerns, war films, you know, those pictures he was drawn to. So I would see a lot of that at home on television. But no one was very highbrow about anything like that at all. And theater was never a part of our life, or, you know, literature really. You know, it was mostly self-discovery, that kind of thing.
So where did the psychological aspect of your storytelling, where did that, where was the inspiration? Or
I guess that's what I was picking up on in you know, whatever picture I was seeing.
I see.
That portion of it interested me, whether there was,
because it was there in John Ford Westerns as much as it is in anything else, right? Or
sure, yeah. I mean, if you watch The Searchers, you know, you can find anything you want.
Yeah,
you can just watch Scar running around and you know, attacking people, or you can pick up on this revenge tale and really see some deep rooted, interesting psychological characters there. So I think that was just something that seemed to interest me in those stories that were being told. And I also, I was watching, when I was relatively young, there was a PBS station locally that would, I think on Friday nights maybe, play a kind of international cinema.
Yeah.
You know, they had a kind of a weird, like, international cinema 101, you know, back when you could call them foreign films, you know, and people didn't take any offense.
So like Bergman,
you would get one Bergman and one Fellini and one, you know, that sort of thing. And I remember gobbling that up.
Really?
You know, I would see Alexander Nevsky one week, and I would see Wild Strawberries, and whether I totally understood them or not, I whatever was different about that, I really liked it.
In the language of cinema, I guess, it sounds lofty, but you were digesting
the sound of you know, I'll put a foreign film on quicker than, I must say, international. Movies from another country. I'll put that on.
Non-American films.
In the background at home, you know, and have that language going. The sound of it is nice. You know, it's like having jazz on.
Yeah.
And those images and all of that. So those were very intoxicating. And so that was attractive to me. And then from there, you start seeking those things out on your own. You know, as soon as you get to college, they had a great international cinema, you know, program that was pretty well, not just well attended, but handled, you know, thoughtfully. So it was curated in a way that, you know, this was this was going. There was kind of thematic themes through it. There's Scandinavian films this weekend and next weekend because it's getting close to Halloween. We'll do Nosferatu and Vampire and, you know, stuff like that. And so I started, you know, once you have access to things, you start gobbling them up. And
sure.
So
yeah.
It was just a, you know, a step-by-step process that led me to where I am now.
Yeah, I guess I remember that period as well. My parents were watching the same films. But I also remember on PBS there were a lot of Japanese films, too. I just have a memory of...
Really?
Like I don't know if they were all Kurosawa, for instance, but they were definitely of that period of samurai movies. You know, many of them were being made. You know, I kind of feel a little bit guilty because I've not been talking about Sun Velvet Morning maybe enough, but... We do.
It's more fun to talk about samurai movies.
Yeah, I guess. But there is, Stanley Tucci's something of a warrior.
As good a segue as I've ever heard. Yes.
But and interesting, I also saw him on stage here in the city a few years back when he did Frankie and Johnny, the Clair de Lune. Did you get to catch that?
I didn't see him in that, but I know. I mean,
with Edie Falco.
He had to be pretty fearless in that because it, it's pretty much like a naked opening, as I recall.
Yes,
and that's the thing about Stanley. He's such a good-natured, friendly fellow, and very charming and effortless, sort of in the way he approaches life. But he's a really fearless performer. And he's a director, and so you get a lot when you get him on set. You know, you have a guy who thinks in kind of the micro and the macro.
You know? Does he push you in a way?
Of course. I mean, in only the best way. I don't mind being pushed that way. Some people just don't like being questioned, there's an insecurity that's masked by a bravado often for people who are in a position of having to make decisions, and they hate to have those decisions questioned or... They want to think they've got the only answers. Mm-hmm. That's just not the way I operate. And so Stanley brings something to the table and has, you know, great thoughts or says, why is this doesn't make sense to me. If it doesn't make sense to him, there's every chance it's not going to make sense to half the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sit down and say, let's figure this out. I mean, you don't have to. You can, you know, create chaos or get upset or, you know, laugh about it and not answer the question. All those things sort of don't lead you further down the process, you know, because the question will come up again. That person, even if they don't say something, will ultimately feel like you're slighting them. You're not collaborating with them in the way that I believe that you should. So you kind of have to embrace that and say, may the best idea win. You know, I come in, my job seems to be to come in with an idea, come in with a way in which to approach a scene, you know, or approach the character. And if his idea is better, we should probably go with that. And that has seemed to serve me relatively well with a very, so far, diverse and talented group of people. Rare has been the person who I've had difficulty with because I think they sense that I'm interested in what they do. I like what they do. I don't do it. I'm not going to try and make them do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of those directors who hires better-looking versions of themselves and then tries to talk that person into acting as if they were acting. It's about you know, I'll get you to here with the script and my idea and create a cocoon for you to work in, and now you do the rest. Mm-hmm. Audiences come to see you. The small group of people who come to this film will, hopefully they'll want to see what I've done and maybe have seen something else. But a lot of them will see Stanley's picture.
Sure.
Or they'll see Alice and they'll go, oh,
right.
I've seen her in something. She's pretty. She was in that Star Trek movie. I want to see what she does.
Yeah.
You know, they are the conduit to an audience. That's who we see them all the time. They're on magazines and we watch them tear up in a movie and we go, oh gosh, I like them so much. And that's why we go back and see what they do the next time.
Absolutely. Sun Velvet Morning, it's going to be on demand starting Tuesday the 10th, I think. And then on in theaters on Friday.
Yes, a certain number December. Of theaters, and certainly in New York and then spreading out.
Thereafter.
Yeah, weirdly, one of the weirdest things is that it's ultimately never, at this point, booked to go to Los Angeles, which...
It is or it's not?
It's not.
Oh.
And Los Angeles, to me, was always, you know, having worked there a fair amount, was always where I would spend a lot of time and see a lot of films like this or films from other countries. But I think, and certainly this applies to films that are on demand,
mm-hmm.
Day and date films or films that are released slightly before... they become of less and less interest to those theaters.
Theater owners, yeah, sure.
And it's a shame, you know, because there's, it's again, it's one of those things you wish the option existed for people to go see it on the screen in a place where you at least know there's a lot of people gathered who apparently want to make films, you know. But I think less and less people want to make Bergman films and more of them want to make Ron Howard films. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's not like a either end of the pole. It's not a disparaging comment. I like Ron Howard, and yet he's someone that you can say there's a guy who's made a lot of movies for studios and films that are of a certain kind of genre, although he's bounced around through many genres. He's just sort of embraced the bigger, bolder, crowd-pleasing aspects of.
Well, he kind of also, that. I mean, in a way, he was also, he's been around for making movies now for like 35 years or something.
That's the thing.
And he's kind of created that road that, with.
And he started with Roger Corman. You couldn't be much more independent.
It's shocking, but it's right.
But I think fewer people, so few people are now interested in what happened at Cannes, even in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Unless they're movies at Cannes. They're like, a year later the Palme d'Or winner comes out and four people are in the theater. Mm-hmm. It's just not about that. It's all about some other aspect of it. If you've based yourself there and you say I want to work in that system, you're not trying to do a film that's quite as personal as somebody else might be doing. So while I was surprised, I guess I can follow the trail and go, oh, I see how this is not happening now. I see how a movie can actually miss playing in
this
one of the biggest cities in the country.
Yeah, which is bizarre, but it's yeah. But you're here in New York. Are you doing any appearances while you're on Friday or
Friday and Saturday? I'm doing a Q&A, I think, somewhere in Village East or something like that.
Okay.
And
it's very strange. I have been called about it, and
isn't that weird?
I don't get it. Must be in my email.
I'm just probably if you trace it,
I'll figure it out.
Junk pile.
I'll be there. Don't worry about it.
That has a slightly chilling quality to it. Oh, don't worry, I'll be there.
Yeah, yeah, yes, it's supposed to.
I'll be in the dark.
Well, I'll be there. make no mistake. Well, again, thank you. And For making time for us. And did you have a wild card round question, Betty?
Oh, heavens.
All I wanted to hear about is the TV show. I can't wait to see it.
That's it. So
I might have to download it, though, illegally. I wonder how you feel about that.
I've been
waiting for it for so long.
I don't feel great about the unlimited. Yeah, I'm not big on that, on the whatever Napster version of movies.
Yeah. Well, it will come out.
I think
eventually.
It does come out eventually on other formats.
You'll have
to do that old-fashioned thing of waiting. it's so quaint these days to see someone who actually can wait for something in this, instantaneous world we live in.
Right.
But I think that, it's like now to think back that even a few years ago we used to wait like 6 months for something to come out on DVD.
Yeah.
Which people can hardly believe that's the way it used to be. But yeah, I think it's one of those things that after DirecTV gets that's sort of the wave of what's going on now is with television that now people are having binge viewing and they're trying to find new ways because so many people are Amazon's creating new content.
Everybody's kind of it's trying to jockey and figure out like what's
going
to come
out. That's why something like what I'm doing here even exists.
Yeah,
is that DirecTV is looking at saying what can we do that. Not just ABC, but HBO won't really do. You know what I mean? They don't want to do black and white and people talking to the camera, so we'll do it. And some of our viewers will appreciate it. And
since
we have so many viewers, because we're DirecTV and we're like, one of these monopolies of cable companies, we can do something interesting.
We're content creators now.
and they say it, and then they do it. And I have to admire that they've twice now gone to bat on formats that you would kind of have people raise their eyebrows about and say, wait a minute, you're not going to have a regular cast and now you're going to do these things where people just talk. God bless them. They've been smart enough to say, that seems interesting to me. So, I'm on the ride with them and I like what they're, that they have the guts to do it.
I can't wait myself then. We'll wait 6 months, get it on Hulu Plus or whatever.
She'll steal it for you. Don't worry.
All right, well,
the reviews are already everywhere, so.
Neil, thank you again, and I appreciate it. We pushed a lot, and you were very
my pleasure.
Warm and friendly and
receptive. Love being pushed around. Thank you.
Count on me, and we'll...
And obviously I'll see you on the weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
Haunting theaters near you.
Yeah, a little bit of the stalking going on.
That's all right.
No, wish you a lot of luck with Some Velvet Morning and with the new series. It does sound great. And
Thank you.
We'll let you get back to your work here. All right.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
What's the problem now?
Don't be condescending to me.
It's starting to make me a little bit worried having you here.
Worried?
No, don't touch
me. You hate games. Do you know that? Because you can't stand to lose.
Gee, and I thought it was all going so well.
Well, that's what people do when they love each other. That's what they do.
How is that fair?
Who said anything about fair? We're talking about love here.
Bam!
Stop calling me Velvet!
All right, okay, you stop.
This is Michel Gondry, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio.
I hope to have Neil regularly. I'm very interested in seeing this new series when it finally is available. I don't have DirecTV, so that stinks. But if you do have DirecTV, please do check in when the series is available. It sounds like it's going to be great. And then eventually, I guess it'll be available on digital platforms. And we'll hopefully remember to make announcements about that when that time does come. Thank you, Neil and Betty, for that. And coming up right now, two friends of mine, and I do mean it when I say friends. I don't mean Facebook friends, because in this case, actually, we did work together on a film. Jason Banker is a cinematographer and a filmmaker, a director. Jorge Torres is also, I would say, a filmmaker, director, and a cinematographer. Together, they also often will work as a team of DPs. For various films, and one of those was this movie I was worked on a couple of summers ago called Richard's Wedding, which you can find, I believe, on iTunes, Richard's Wedding. And Jason and Jorge, I met these guys, and they're the sweetest guys, and they have made a movie called Toad Road. It was recently in theaters. I think it's still, I mean, in New York when I say that, and pardon me for being so New York-centric, because truthfully, the movie is still opening around. In fact, we do discuss it, that it is being distributed by Tug, which is a company which crowdsources screening. So if you can get 100 folks or however many, maybe it's 50, maybe it's 200, I don't know, to rally and to purchase a ticket, I guess, to they will actually put a screening in your neighborhood, and you can go to, you can organize these screenings through Tug. And I've been actually intending to get somebody from Tug to come on the show and talk about it. So I'm glad in a way that this happened, because it will help to kind of motivate me to get moving on that. So Jason Banker and Jorge Torres, I know it's an unusual last name, and you'll find out more about that. The long and the short of it is that Toad Road is playing around in various cities around the country, or will have these one-off, or will have these one-off screenings. But you can go to Tug, the website, if you're interested after this or right now, and organize a screening in your neighborhood. But Jason and Jorge, I've got a lot of projects going on. They shoot very, very fast and furious, not at the cost of good stories, but their approach is a bit different than many other filmmakers. So anyway, it's been a long time. I've been wanting them on the show, and finally it is great to have them and sit down with them and talk about a lot of stuff, frankly. Now, there was a minor, I don't want to make more out of it than there is, but Toad Road did have a bit of a controversy around it, which was that one of the actors, her name was Sarah Ann Jones, died after the film was finished, an apparent suicide. And and Jason, I think, was criticized in a couple of cases about how things were handled afterwards, and the problem of promoting a film right on top of something like that happens is very tricky, very difficult, very hard for everybody. And so we get into it only just a little during the conversation, but rightfully so, he was very, very hesitant to start talking about it. It's a sensitive issue, and I think he feels really very badly about it. And so, you know, and if you're interested in learning more, it's not very difficult, though. So to find information about what happened. And right now, the segment with Jason Banker and Jorge Torres, and we'll be back afterwards.
I'm he seriously kidding. Wants to get knocked out.
I'm not fucking kidding. As hard as you can.
Are you recording?
Right here. All right,
this is James getting knocked out.
My life is falling apart around me. I'm losing everything. I wake up every day and I feel like shit. It just doesn't seem worth it anymore. Why me? Toad Road. It's like the local high school urban legend.
I just kind of wanted to drop some acid and just see what happened.
So thank you, Jason Banker and Jorge Torres.
Thank you for letting us come on.
Yeah, thank you.
That was in stereo. Okay, so we have to do one thing, and that's like try to make it easier to distinguish who's talking. Because, right, and you sounded a little alike right then.
I sounded like Jorge.
All right. Jason has a slightly higher register. Slightly. Just ever so slightly. You have an especially low register. Let me put it that way. Maybe that's less insulting.
Very low.
Hello.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
great. Good. Yes.
Yeah. It's so nice to have you both because it's like family almost.
Yeah. I thought we would have been on this a little sooner.
You know, it's true. I went back in the day. I had a show devoted to the movie we all worked on a couple of summers ago called Richard's Wedding. Yeah. And I had on a few of the cast members at one point right before we had our theatrical at Rerun. And you guys were missing, but there's only so many mics. And you were probably, like, running around shooting things anyway.
Yeah, I don't know.
Jason.
What else were we doing at that time?
Trying to pay rent.
Yeah.
Barely.
Right. It can be tricky, right? It's like drought or flood with these, right? As you know, DPs.
Yeah, I think we shot more of Orner's music videos for Block.
Oh, right. How many did you do?
Like 30 of those.
I know that's not true. Did he actually like release like a triple album?
I don't know if it was triple, but it was more than just a single album. It had multiple stuff on there.
Really?
Yeah.
So did you really do like a dozen videos? Do you think?
No, I think we did more like 9 or
that's
eight or 7 maybe. Wow. Maybe 6.
I was in one.
Which one?
You weren't there. I have to think about it. Were you guys there? The one in the alley and I was like stripped to the.
No, we would have remembered.
Yeah, it was Matt Grady was there that day, but I'm trying to remember who was on the camera. It's all blank. Anyway, I want to welcome you both. We're here loosely based on the fact that you have your latest collaboration. Although Jason, I guess you're the director, right, Jason?
Yeah.
And
Toad Road is just. Well, it was just in theaters a couple weeks ago, and the DVD release will be on December 17th.
In the digital...
And the VOD, yeah.
In the VOD, right? So that's what kind of was the catalyst, let's say. But as we also said, it's just great to get together and talk about it. Because I actually feel like, even though we've known each other for a couple of years now, I don't really know that much about either one of you. So this is it. Ambush time, baby.
I think we've gotten to know each other. I think it's just been nights that were there's a lot of drinking and not much is remembered the next day. So, but we know each other very well. We just don't remember it.
Right, exactly. It's almost like Groundhog's Day where we get to know each other really well, and then the next morning we've forgotten. Everything's been erased.
Yeah, we're just meant to fall in love every time we go out.
Let me find it. So you're both. DPs and as well as of course directing and set it up for me a little bit, your a little bit of background, a little bit of your backgrounds, and also like how you guys ended up forming this creative partnership, because you've been working together for a while, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I started when I moved to New York to get into filmmaking here.
Which was when, Jason?
That was in 97.
Oh, that's a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I met Jonathan Coet. He was like the first film friend that I had here.
Did you just run into him at a film event or something?
No, a friend, like basically the first guy that I met in New York, his name was Dagan James, and he introduced me to Jonathan. And he was just like, you got to meet this guy. You have a lot of, you know, things in common. You're both...
like aesthetically or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I met Jonathan and we kind of hit it off and started making shorts together. You know, exactly what you moved to New York for is to meet somebody that you can work with. And eventually he made Tarnation, which was the biggest thing that at that time that we had been doing. And... it kind of took off, and
I'll say,
you know,
that was made while he was already living in New York. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he had been shooting stuff with him and his family. Yeah, his whole life.
I mean, right. That was an archival project, really, is what it was. But
yeah, it was kind of actually when iMovie came out, we had been talking about doing digital filmmaking because at that time it was the transitional period between shooting on film and, you know, digital stuff. So when iMovie came out, he kind of took it and ran with it. And, you know, Tarnation was born out of that.
Right.
And I, you know, was there working with him, you know, on that. And yeah. That's
just helping him edit? I mean, because it sounds like it was primarily in editing. Although, I guess.
Yeah, no, I did a lot of the stuff that required After Effects. So it was like the split screen scenes.
Oh.
And there's a couple things that I shot in the film that, you know, it's uncredited because it was kind of minor stuff, but, you know, I did help creatively a lot with the film.
I remember seeing that when it came out at the Cinema Village off University.
Yeah.
So you said you came to New York in, like, the late 90s. Where'd you grow up, just so I
grew up in Pennsylvania, okay. York, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. All right. Jorge.
I am from Puerto Rico.
Is that where you grew up?
Yes, I grew up in Puerto Rico. I lived there till I was 15, and then I moved to Louisiana, and I was there for a good 10 years. And then I lived in Georgia, Athens, Georgia, for 5, and then got my dose of the Southern experience, and that's why we keep coming back. We've made, like, 3 other features down there, because it's just crazy, crazy land. It's wonderful, beautiful, and...
yeah, and you get all the crazy characters.
Yes.
For
yeah, some of them are like people we've known for like 20 years that their lives haven't really, you know, panned out a certain way, and they're willing to share that and open that door. Because that's what we, just like documentaries, open doors to places that you wish you could visit. We kind of do that too, and then add this magic realism fantasy to it and horror, and but it's really grounded in like people's like tragedies or like very intense like experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that's something you both just really obviously find compelling.
Yes.
So that you met Jorge in New York?
Yeah, I met Jorge through Jonathan, actually. I you know, it was, when was it, do you think? 2000. We met in 2007.
It was like late 2007, yeah.
Yeah.
At a party, and then he was like, here's Jason. Jason, here's Jorge. And then we had the same cameras, and we started shooting
Toad Road. Yeah, I basically had just started shooting Toad Road by myself, and I met Jorge, and he had the same camera, and I was like, oh, my God, like, let's shoot 2 cameras. You know, so he came down, and that's kind of how it started.
So is it you just have 2 exact same model cameras, and then you have the same settings, and you're going to have the exact same looking results, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we both
makes
had
sense.
The Panasonic HVX 200, which at the time was the camera. So
yeah,
we made pretty much 5 or 6 features with that camera.
Now, I remember from our combined experience with the Richard wedding that having two DPs basically cuts your time, if not in half, substantially. Was that always the way you guys pitched yourselves as a? I mean, I don't know how many projects you've done, and I don't know if you've ever done anything for anybody else other than Richard's Wedding, for instance.
I don't know. Jorge, do you want
to? Richard's Wedding, I think, uses the two camera approach to just, you know, minimize takes and have real-time cutaways and, you know, just move along. Orner Tokau likes to, he's just quick. He's like, shoot, go, let's go, now, done. And then, but when we do two cameras, I think we use it more we use them more for documentary stuff. So we're just covering stuff and floating around. And our styles, our framing is very similar. So at times, we're not even sure whose shot it is when we're watching the dailies. We kind of forget. So we just do it to get a lot of footage and you know, just a documentary approach, basically.
Yeah,
capture as much as we can.
It helps when things are only going to happen once that you have more than one camera on it. You know, it just it gives you a feeling that maybe it was something that was planned when you have two cameras, because you're. It feels like traditional coverage, but, you know, you're just catching it like that.
Traditional coverage, for those listening, I mean, that's when you would, somebody's doing a scene and you do it over and over, the scene, from different angles. So when you go to editing, you have lots of choices. So I guess it is what you're doing. I mean, you're really just trying to get, but you're not doing it in the conventional style, I guess.
Every take that has two cameras is different from the next one, because it's never, we don't script, so each take has a different flow, like
right.
the actors are or the actors, non-actors, they're all improvising a different tone, like sometimes it's shorter, longer, and then then you take all those and you just kind of gel them into one. It becomes a lot of footage, just like documentary stuff. We, you know, you just kind of create the story during editing. And
so I guess one could say, or one should say, that Tarnation is a documentary, and then Richard's Wedding is not, but or Toad Road is a narrative. It's a horror film, I suppose.
Road also is, it's a documentary too. That's the whole thing.
So talk about how you conceived of this and maybe how it evolved then.
Yeah, well, Toad Road kind of came out of documentary filmmaking. I wanted to do my first narrative feature, and I wanted it to be, you know, as close to the like a documentary as possible, as far as the realness of it. And so that was kind of my initial thing, was to make a horror film, like doc horror kind of thing. And it was like an experiment in a weird way. It's reality, and then you're mixing like a fiction that's very fictional, like a road to hell. Yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to do. And it took me a while to get it out there and to get it kind of finished. And Jorge really helped me with that process too, because he's also exploring that same thing. And so together we've kind of just come about this brand of filmmaking, I suppose.
Yeah. And can you talk about, I guess, the what occurred, if you can.
What, in the film?
Yeah. And
well, yeah.
How you've kind of dealt with it is, you know, in the exhibition of the film.
Yeah, no, I wanted to use a group of real friends that had relationships that were already established and use their real personalities in the film and kind of play off of the inherent drama between maybe just different people in that group. And I don't know. I mean, it was a weird process, because I started shooting with them before I knew who was going to be the lead and like how we were actually going to do it. I just started shooting it as a documentary, and then slowly brought in fictional scenes and brought that story out after I had kind of enough character development and like knew who was going to play what and like paired people up. And then, yeah, like I said, it took a while to kind of get the fiction to work with the documentary elements. Like,
yeah,
it was a
pace,
kind of a
tone.
Putting a puzzle together, for sure.
Yeah. Was there a moment when it kind of crystallized, like, oh, you know, this could use this fictional element, and then...
Yeah, it was kind of like a slow... It was just a slow process, okay. really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked on the film for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, basically, to mm-hmm. get it completely done.
And all your subjects slash characters, what was their level of cooperation or...
Yeah, no, it was definitely... You
know, I know that there was a tragedy that occurred.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely difficult because I think at a certain point when the business of actually making the film, when it came down to like doing these specific scenes and going and doing that, it was a little difficult to get them to do it because they didn't really have aspirations to be actors as much as I would have hoped maybe. But they definitely stuck with it because they believed in the project and they were excited about it. You know, it ended up working. It was just not... Mm-hmm. Definitely not an easy process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. And so, Jorge, you came on to it at a certain point?
Kind of within the first year, you kind of start talking uh-huh. to these people, to all these kids. And yeah, and then immediately you just brought me to Baltimore, and all of a sudden we were, my first scene shooting on Toad Road was just like ecstasy party, and it was just wild, and I was like, holy shit, and like
what have I got into?
Yeah, no, it was pretty insane, and I got along with all the guys, and we didn't even have a sound guy, so it was pretty intimate. They were just wild, as wild as they are with or without cameras around, and then I started editing and just having fresh set of eyes on the film, because there is a lot of structuring the narrative through the editing. So there were just many, many, many cuts with variations and just all these outtakes and parties and going swimming at the Rock, things that never made it into the film. Yeah. I'd learned a lot that, you know, we start sort of applying what we were learning with these other films we were making simultaneously, because it was taking so long to make Toad Road. So we were just making documentaries on squatters and made My Name is Faith. And then I made Shadow Zombie, which follows up the aesthetics of like Toad Road and sort of having a strong relationship with your subject, to where they're very willing to fictionalize their accounts and improvise and let their selves be used as the characters to this story that we're sort of kind of making up as we go along.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about what happened with one of the women in the film? It's obviously a really sensitive subject, so
yeah. I mean, I'd rather not talk about it. Mm-hmm. If that's okay.
Yeah, I guess it's okay. Did it create a difficulty for you in terms of your showing it at recently, or of getting people out from the film? And
well, the film had already premiered. Mm-hmm. It already had premiered before she passed away. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, mm-hmm. it's, yeah, I mean, it's hard to talk about, so I'd rather not.
That's totally understandable given the suit.
Is that okay?
Totally understandable.
It's just, it's, you know, it's just hard to, it's, I don't know, it's hard to talk about in the sense of the film and the process, and it's part of,
yeah, I don't know. And maybe it doesn't honor the person as well as you want to,
right? But yeah, I don't think I could ever. I don't think I could.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah. Now, Jorge, how did you become connected with our friend Jonathan Coet? Because he seems to be the bridge, the common thread.
I had met Jonathan like briefly during John Cameron Mitchell's the shooting of Short Bus. And
I know it. You look familiar.
Yeah. And he was on set, Jonathan Coet, and John introduced me to him briefly. And then it wasn't until like a few years later that Jonathan was looking for interns for All Tomorrow's Parties, because there was just, you know, like 1,000 hours of footage. And he I just happened to go to this party that he was just having with all these people that I got introduced to, and Jason was one of them. And yeah, he was just like, "You're gonna like this guy." And it's like, cool. We were smoking weed afterwards. Awesome.
Absolutely. So it's a recurring theme in my podcast. I noticed lifelong relationships, you know, sown from the cannabis seed.
It was a really hot night. Was it?
Yeah,
it was an August night, and Jonathan doesn't have AC, and we were all drinking wine, and we were sweating, and it was awesome.
Good memories. And so Code Road was the long-term project. Must have felt kind of good to complete it and to get it out into the world, I guess. As well.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's been an amazing year. The past year has been great. Yeah, just to be working on for something so long, and then it actually does pretty well when it comes out, and you know, it got to be in theaters, and yeah.
I think I've noticed that it's still coming out in, yeah, in very different spots.
It's on,
right?
Tug right now, so you can.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's a couple shows up. Like it just played in Miami from something that was on Tug, like an event. So you know,
does it mean your people are crowdsourcing screenings, or
yeah?
Or
do you know what Tug is?
Yeah, I thought it was a way to, if you get enough people to request a screening, that they'll get one.
Yeah, no, totally. I didn't know what it was until this film, you know, and then my producers were like, "We're going to put it on Tug," and I was like, "Oh, what's that?" But it's been working out pretty well.
So are they one-offs, or?
Yeah, it's a one-off screening.
And frankly, really, do you need it? You know what I'm saying? It's like if you have a theatrical, right, in New York, you get your reviews that you need or would like, maybe. And then it's nice if there's an infrastructure to support theatricals around the country, but getting it for a couple of screenings in a bunch of different places can be very rewarding, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have gone to Miami. But, no, I mean, yeah, having the New York, and we had a L.A. run, week run in both cities, and that was, you know, as much as I could have ever dreamed to have, so I'm glad I did.
So it's going to be on on demand, on cable, too? Or is it?
I'm not sure. Right now it's on iTunes pre-order, and it's on, you know, Amazon.com. You can buy the DVD from a lot of different places. But, yeah, December 17th.
Birthday.
Yeah, and it happens to be my birthday just by chance.
And we'll have a party for the combined two causes of celebration. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. So tell me what you are currently working on then, guys. Jorge, what are you?
This year, besides Sturd Road.
I saw that, right? Shadow Zombie.
No, it hasn't played here in New York.
What did I see at Videology, though? Remind me.
You saw my first film, Pre-Paradise.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry.
This year we were working on, Toad Road was coming out, and we also had this other documentary called My Name is Faith, which we co-directed, and it is about kids with reactive attachment disorder, and it's pretty. It's just children that have been brought up in very, very tough circumstances. Kids that have been abandoned and sent to orphanages, and just gotten the worst upbringing, to where they have emotional issues that are so deeply rooted and violent that they just get passed down. They just, parents give up. And we made a film with Tiffany Sodella Junker about her daughter Faith, and we follow her as she goes through these sort of behavioral camps.
How old is the daughter? How old is Faith?
She was like 9 or something. 9 to 11. And we just made this sort of intimate portrait of her journey, and it was something that we were working on alongside Toad Road this year, that was just both coming out at the same time. But then I had this documentary called The Life, Love, and Hate of a Free Jazz Man and His Woman, and that premiered at the Sidewalk Film Festival this year. And then Shadow Zombie premiered the month after that.
Wow, that is a lot of... That's a lot.
But also, yeah, in New Orleans, also we also had this other feature. We had two features. The other one was another one that we shot, produced, and edited called Hillbilly Wolf, which is a film by our good friend Bradford Willingham. So it was kind of a crazy few months of just projects that we had been working on alongside Toad Road that were just kind of coming out at the same time.
Yeah, when is My Name is Faith? When is that going? Or when do you think you guys are shooting for that?
I think that's early 2014. I don't know what the exact release date is, but the VOD should be sometime in there.
Great. Oh. Lots more things to look forward to and more things to feel bad about not making, potentially, on my end. So I will make a point of coming and getting there. Just so hard sometimes. I was so good for a while there, but it's just gotten so difficult. You know, with my kid, I have a kid, so his mom has been in a play, and so my weekends now are much more difficult for me to, you know, I don't have as much flexibility. It's good, though.
I wish people could see that look you're giving us. It's good.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's not, I should be less busy. That's truly the thing, and just go away with my kid. And when are you guys going to start a family? Not together, but, you know, think about that.
A family of what?
Young cinematographers. I don't
know. Yeah. No, all of our money goes into making our films. That's the one thing, like, it's, you know, a lot of our stuff is, there's no script to sell to anybody to say, hey, you know. So I think for us it's very hard to get financing for anything. So we just pretty much know that if we're going to make a film, we're going to have to spend our own money to do it. So, like the new project that I started doing is all self-financed, and it's fine. I think, like Orner too, he kind of in a weird way makes these films that he just uses like friends of his that finance these, you know, $10,000-$15,000 films, and that's kind of the ballpark that me and Jorge are kind of working in right now too.
But that's the tricky part, though. It's like the older you get, the harder, you know, it is to like juggle the machine. And like now it's interesting to like try to dive into the writing, which is, I feel like I don't even know how to write. Like, I feel we've been making films backwards and we've gotten to figure out how to make them backwards. So now we're trying to make them to where we can involve other people and follow a more familiar structure so we can make bigger projects that are as kind of wild, but at the same time just reach like another audience and, you know, just it kind of expand but never lose like the
I think this is where Jorge and I have our difference of opinions. I mean, I
oh, do we?
A little bit. No, I've just been on the fence with this like process, which is just going with a camera and starting. Like, I actually like starting to make films before I even know what the film is going to be. Like, which is kind of a very, you know, typical documentary approach. You find your subject that you're intrigued with, and then you start shooting, and you see where it goes, and you kind of develop the story as you're shooting with them. I mean, I really like making films that way. It's more fun for me. It's more interesting. But as Jorge's saying, it's tough because, you know, you're kind of doing it all on your own. And I think Jorge, he's actually a really good writer, I think. He doesn't think so, right?
No.
But we are going to try and do, you know, something more traditionally produced where you have a script but it's hard for me. I kind of like this scrappier doc style thing, and I actually wouldn't mind doing it forever.
No, I mean, and that's the thing though. I'd like to expand to where I can maybe have a bigger budget film that could make me make like 10 other Shadow Zombies or Toad Roads and just kind of like expand on the concept of, I don't know, just how real you can get things to be without breaking them, regardless of budget.
No, I understand. I understand. What excites you and what gets your creative, you know, I hate to say creative blood flowing, whatever, but that's, you know, essentially it. It is the spontaneity and the not knowing. I understand, yeah. And you, on the other hand, Jorge,
no,
monetize
I mean,
it slightly more reliably.
No, I mean, even when I was working on Shadow Zombie, uh-huh. like with Jason, halfway through the movie, we were like deciding to kill characters off and mm-hmm. adding new characters that showed up. Where I'm, that was that having those situations happen, a quote unquote set is like, it's pretty amazing because if you're that excited about the unthinkable things that are happening, mm-hmm. a character all of a sudden takes off her leg and you're like, oh my God, this just got very intimate and bizarre mm-hmm. and beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would never like trade that for anything. I do. I have grown up with Hollywood films and my dad was a film collector. So I'm very intrigued with like the big studio. Even though I'm almost allergic to it, but I'm just curious. You know,
what do you mean he was a film collector?
He just collected 16mm films.
He did?
Yeah, he had a few hundred and he exchanged. And mm-hmm. The biggest room in our house in Puerto Rico was a mini theater. Everybody else had the small rooms. The biggest room was my dad's theater. And we watched films every single night when he got off work. And I had better English accent by the time I was 7 because I watched so many American films. So
was there a genre that he was specifically?
Yeah, actually Westerns and like just horror films.
Like Howard Hawks films and John Ford films.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And also horror films. So he was in love with the Hammer Studio.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Stuff from the 60s, Christopher Lee, you know, Peter Cushing, all that stuff.
Wow.
See, Jason doesn't want to make an Abbott and Costello movie with me. That's the problem.
Oh, therein lies the problem. I'll make it with you. I'm a bad boy. Both your parents, were they last named Torres? Is that the origin story?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, thank you for that.
I found out like 7 years ago through my grandmother that my parents didn't know they were distant cousins. And
it all makes so much sense, though, right?
So it became a huge funny thing. And I thought that it would be fun to just use that name when dealing with film.
I think it's great.
Only.
Yeah. It's good. It's like a punchline slap, but it's, you know, it's a nice.
It's my life.
Yeah, but it's right. And last thing I want to ask you, Jorge, sorry, Jason, is you mentioned before we sat down, you mentioned that you're also pre-screening for Slam Dance
programming. At this point,
it's got to be great. Well, it's got to be over now, right?
Yeah, it's over. They just notified that notification date passed, and I was just programming narrative shorts.
Nice. Are you going to be? So you're going to go?
No, I'm going to be. I'm working on another documentary right now, and I'm going to.
Of course, you are.
I'm going to be on tour with this band.
Which one?
This band called The Skins.
Mm-hmm.
They're produced by Adrien Grenier.
Oh.
And they're just. It's their rise to rock and roll stardom.
Great. Yeah. Nothing like a good music doc.
To dance to.
Mm hmm. Yeah. Glad Adrien's found work. You know, that he's okay. He's doing okay.
He's doing all right.
I'm sure. All right. Well, guys, let's not take this long a time to do it again. Seriously.
Yeah. No, thanks. Glad to finally be on the show.
Yeah, me too. You know.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Adam.
Pleasure. We will do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. Thanks, guys. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, but I did want to say that I've been holding on to this interview with Al Maisels. You know, he's the venerable, one of the pioneers of Verite documentary making, and he was very generous to come on the show some time ago. I'm finally putting it up, almost in, because it's the holidays, I want to slow things down, so I had the show. So I'm gonna finally post it in a few days, and you'll have that one, and then we're gonna kind of go dark for a week or two during the holidays, and then we'll be right back afterwards with a whole bunch of great new episodes. So I just wanted to personally thank everybody for their support, and I might put up some special best of moments or some special material on iTunes, but I gonna take a little break, I think, just for a week or two, because to refuel, as it were. So, but I do want to thank you tremendously when you do something from the ground up like this podcast, and then you see that people are starting to really take note of it and maybe find it valuable to them. It means a lot, and so I just wanted to say that. Yeah, again, this is been a terrific year, but we'll be back, in, as I said, with Al Maisels next week. And then, so please do continue to tune in. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, the independent film podcast, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T.